Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we open our show with top national news from Public News Service, including a report from the Nonpartisan Government Accounting Office, which has found that President Donald Trump broke the law in his actions involving the Ukraine. The news comes just as the House has sent impeachment papers to the Senate. We'll also have a report on how the Iowa presidential primary might be impacted by four candidates who are senators returning to Washington for the impeachment trial slated to begin in the coming week. In local news, East County Magazine and the Grossmont Mount Helix Improvement Association invite you to a forum on January 30th in La Mesa with all four candidates running for county supervisor in the 2nd District, the very important seat being vacated by Diane Jacob due to term limits. Hear how you can submit your questions for these candidates on today's show. Also hear about a ban on vaping product sales just passed by supervisors. And then on Green Scene, we'll have a report on efforts to declare a local butterfly species endangered, news about Santee's new sustainable Santee plan, and how the San Diego Zoo's experts are helping injured and displaced wildlife in Australia due to brush fires there. As we honor the memory of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. this week, we also mourn the passage of Dr. Carol Wayman, San Diego's most prominent civil rights activist. Learn about his remarkable life and achievements for equality on today's show. We'll have details on the death of wildlife biologist and eagle expert John David Bittner, best known for running the Hawk Watch program in Ramona. On sports, hear about the retirement of Aztecs football coach Rocky Long and who's been chosen to replace the all-time most winning coach in the Mountain West. On the second half of our show today, our newsmaker interview is with Nancy Cassidy. She's a Democrat challenging Congressman Scott Peters in the 52nd Congressional District, and she's running on a Green New Deal platform. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for January the 17th, 2020. I'm Mike Clifford. The White House violated federal law when it withheld security aid to Ukraine last year. That's according to a decision by a congressional watchdog group, the Washington Post reporting the Government Accountability Office, a nonpartisan agency that reports to Congress, found that the Trump administration broke a law that governs how the White House disperses money approved by Congress when they withheld $214 million worth of equipment, training, and other support to help Ukraine in its battle against Russian-backed separatist forces. The Post adds that Pentagon aid was overwhelmingly approved by a bipartisan majority in the Congress. The GAO report came as the Senate opened the impeachment trial of President Trump. Corporations and super PACs have poured almost $1 billion by some estimates into American elections. That since the U.S. Supreme Court handed down its Citizens United decision 10 years ago next week.
The court decision freed companies to make unlimited political donations without declaring the true sources of what's come to be known as dark money. Robert Weissman, president of the good government watchdog group Public Citizen, says that has led to a system rigged to benefit the super rich.
The top 25 donors are responsible for nearly half of all the individual contributions that have gone to super PACs since the Citizens United decision. So we really are looking at an oligarchic situation.
Weissman says that means issues that enjoy wide public support, like bills to prevent gun violence, lower prescription drug prices, or fight climate change, have languished in Congress as many lawmakers depend on funds from the gun lobby and drug and energy company. Supporters of the decision say it allows all corporations to have a voice in the political process, not just the ones with media empires. I'm Suzanne Potter.
In 2018, California passed the Disclose Act, which requires ads from independent political committees to prominently display their primary funders. I'm Mike Clifford from Public News Service. We are a member and we are listener-supported. We're online at publicnewsservice.org.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
A Senate trial is expected to keep you in Washington in the weeks leading up to the Iowa caucuses here. How big of a problem is that for you as you're making your closing pitch to voters here?
Look, some things are more important than politics.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is one of four Democrats running for president tied up in Washington for the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump, along with Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, Bernie Sanders of Vermont, and Michael Bennett of Colorado. Here's Bennett.
Those of us that are running have to make sure we fulfill our responsibilities, our constitutional responsibilities back in Washington at the same time, and I think we can.
Professor of political science at Iowa State, Dirk Diem, says the trial won't necessarily be bad for the campaigns. The senators will get lots of press after each session. But with the upcoming Iowa caucuses and New Hampshire primaries,
it does leave the other candidates free rein to campaign.
The president himself will be in the Hawkeye State Monday night for a campaign rally. His Republican primary challengers have also been campaigning in Iowa and New Hampshire, former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, and here's former Illinois Congressman Joe Walsh.
It's our goal to have people wake up the day after Iowa and say, oh my God, that's interesting. Joe Walsh did pretty well in Iowa. There is a race.
Yesterday, Walsh's complaints about the 10 states that canceled their Republican primaries, most recently Wisconsin, were ignored again, this time in person at the Republican National Committee's headquarters.
Here's what's weird and just wrong. I'm a lifelong Republican. I'm a former Republican congressman. I'm a Republican candidate for president. And here I was today at Republican headquarters in D.C. to talk about the disenfranchisement of Republican voters, and nobody here would talk to me.
Meanwhile, just before the trial opened, the Senate passed the new NAFTA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, the day after President Trump signed phase one of a trade deal with China. Warren and Klobuchar gave their rationales for voting for the USMCA on this week's debate stage.
It will give some relief to our farmers. It will give some relief to our workers. I believe we accept that relief. We try to help the people who need help. And we get up the next day and fight for a better trade deal.
These are real people hurt by Donald Trump's trade war.
Sanders joined 10 other senators who voted against incremental change in trade policy, including three former 2020 presidential candidates, Kamala Harris of California, Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, and Cory Booker of New Jersey.
We could do much better than a Trump-led trade deal. This deal, and I think the proponents of it acknowledge, will result in the continuation of the loss of hundreds of thousands of good-paying jobs as a result of outsourcing.
Plus, he says, it doesn't mention the words climate change. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
This is Jonathan Getz, a forum for candidates running for San Diego County Supervisor in District 2, which includes most of East County, will be held on Wednesday, January 29th at Murdoch Elementary School in La Mesa. The forum is sponsored by the Grossmont Mount Helix Improvement Association and East County Magazine. All four candidates running for the East County seat have indicated they will attend. The candidates are former State Senator Joel Anderson, Poway Mayor Steve Voss, Kenya Taylor, co-chair of the Southeastern Live Well Center Health Work Group, and Brian Sesko, a broker and general contractor. The candidates are running to fill the seat that will be vacated by Supervisor Diane Jacob, who will be leaving office after 28 years because of term limits. You can submit questions for the candidates by emailing questions to editor@eastcountymagazine.org or to yourgmianeighbor@gmail.com. Written questions will also be accepted at the forum. Kathleen Hedberg, president of the GMIA, says, "The role of our supervisor is critical to our unincorporated region. The unincorporated area does not have a city council and is governed by decisions made by the Board of Supervisors, which can have a tremendous impact on our area," she adds. Miriam Raftery, the editor of East County Magazine, says, "County supervisors make decisions that affect people across our region, including major land use decisions on housing developments, energy projects, sand mine proposals, parks, preserves, and more. Supervisors also cast votes that impact countywide fire protection, health and human services, homelessness, agriculture, and many other important issues. The second supervisorial district includes 620,000 residents and spans 2,000 square miles from the eastern communities in the city of San Diego, east to the Imperial County line, south to the Mexican border, and north through Julian and Santa Isabel. It encompasses five incorporated cities, as well as rural, mountain, and desert towns, plus several Native American reservations. The event begins at 5:30 p.m. with an opportunity to meet the candidates. The forum, which will be moderated by the League of Women Voters, starts at 6 p.m. After the forum ends at 8 p.m., candidates for Superior Court judge seats and the 71st and 79th Assembly District have also been invited for a meet and greet with those attending. You can find full details on the January 29th candidate forum at eastcountymagazine.org in our politics section.
By a 3-2 vote, San Diego County supervisors have tentatively approved a moratorium on sales and distribution of electronic cigarette or vaping devices, also flavored vaping products and smokeless tobacco, although hookahs are exempted. The board majority also voted to ban outdoor smoking at restaurants. If final approval is made on February 28th, the regulations will take effect July 1st and run through February 28th of 2021. The ban on vaping items could be lifted sooner if the U.S. Center for Disease Control changes its directives, which currently advises consumers to avoid all vaping and e-cigarette use due to sudden and severe lung illnesses. Supervisors Kristen Gaspar and Jim Desmond voted against the ban. Desmond said he supports the right of adults over 21 to choose whether to use vaping or other tobacco products and voiced doubt whether a ban would prevent minors from accessing products found online. But Supervisor Diane Jacob, who supported the ban along with Chairman Greg Cox and Supervisor Nathan Fletcher, noted that vaping-related illnesses have sickened thousands nationwide and killed at least 55 people. Jacob noted that the board could take no action while the federal investigation into the health crisis continues, but, she said, that's not what leadership is about. She added that the most surefire way for people to prevent risk is to avoid all use of tobacco and vaping products. The agency item drew 60 public speakers, with 2/3 in favor of the moratorium. Those included teachers and health representatives from the American Heart Association and the American Lung Association. Those opposed included owners of vaping and smoke shops, who argued that the ban could put them out of business. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has announced a proposal to add the Hermes copper butterfly as a threatened species under the Federal Endangered Species Act. This butterfly is found only in San Diego County and in northwest Baja California, Mexico. Now, the Federal Wildlife Agency wants to designate 35,000 acres of protected critical habitat here in San Diego County, working in partnership with SANDAG and the Marines. The plan also calls for a captive breeding program and reintroduction of the butterflies into the wild. The habitat protection includes exemptions for firefighting, fuel breaks, and other public safety actions. The butterflies are orange and brown on their wings, with yellow underneath and black spots. They lay their eggs only on spiny redberry bushes found in chaparral and coastal sage habitats up to 45 miles inland. The proposal follows 28 years of petitions and several lawsuits filed by the Center for Biological Diversity seeking protection for the Hermes copper butterfly. Tara Cornelis, a scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity, says Californians love their native butterflies, and it's important to protect San Diego County's remaining islands of habitat for this rare butterfly. Decline of the butterfly has mirrored the destruction of Southern California's native ecosystems, Cornelis adds. Urban sprawl, rampant wildfires, and climate change are a triple threat to this beautiful butterfly, which desperately needs Endangered Species Act protection, the environmental leader concludes.
This is Jonathan Getz with the local government report from Santee. Santee, like most small cities in the state, is strapped for funds. Council members are unhappy about complying with the many mandates from legislators in Sacramento. The city council finally scratched one lingering mandate off its list this month, unanimously approving a sustainable Santee action plan. That's the climate action plan every city in California must create to demonstrate a commitment to reduce greenhouse gases. Santee began the process of creating a climate action plan back in 2014, but stopped when funding was deemed insufficient. Efforts resumed in 2017. The total cost for the 432-page document was $275,000. Mayor John Minto, speaking at the January 8th meeting, made no bones about why the city was shelling out such sums. He said, We talked about getting a plan that doesn't drag us off into court, he said, adding cynically, but the state will probably change the playing field and drag us into court. When the city's climate plan first came before the council in August, it spurred a flurry of opposition from local environmental groups and others, who criticized it as being worthless because the vast majority of the proposed goals and measures were voluntary. The new wording calls for mandatory audits for specific triggering events. For example, the first goal in the plan calls for increased energy efficiency in existing residential units. If a homeowner now decides to expand or do any significant remodeling, that will result in a mandatory energy audit. City staffers and consultants said such audits could easily be accomplished by calling San Diego Gas and Electric, which offers assessments without charge and provides free LED bulbs, as well as other low-cost energy efficiency components to owners. But Councilman Rob McNellis said such audits could cost homeowners significant amounts, such as when an old refrigerator is deemed too high in emissions and must be replaced with a new model. He also railed at another recent mandate from the state requiring businesses to install an electric recharging station at 5% of their parking spaces. He asked, if you're a small business, where are you going to come up with the money? Van Collingsworth, the leader of Preserve Wild Santee, criticized the latest version of the climate plan, saying it gave the appearance of taking action without requiring sufficient action and could do more harm than good. He also ripped the council for not taking the easiest and quickest step in reducing emissions, which is joining a community choice energy program. Santee examined options to join a couple of community choice programs last year, along with the city of San Diego and some other local cities, but decided to pass. Instead, Santee indicated it will consider working with San Diego County, which is considering forming a community choice program in the future. According to the Santee Climate Action Plan's lofty goals, the city pledges to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 40% below 2005 levels in the year 2030. The biggest causes of these emissions, 91%, are the ever-increasing number of vehicles in and around the city. Several members railed at environmentalists who criticized the city's climate plan as inadequate, stating that Santee has been actively working towards improving the main highway into the city, State Route 52. Councilman Ron Hall said, "Who's working to decrease that traffic? We are. Let's get the climate action people to go down to Sandag and tell them to fix the 52. Even Councilman Stephen Houlihan, a strong environmental supporter who recently declared plans to run for mayor, was less than enthusiastic with the final product. But, he stated, this is a compromise that's been a long time in coming. We'll be finally doing something. Houlihan responded to one speaker who said because the developers of Finita Ranch contributed some $93,000 to offset the plan's cost, it was tantamount to giving the developer, Home Fed Corp., a rubber stamp for its pending 3,000-unit housing project. Houlihan promised, this won't be a rubber stamp for Finita Ranch. Finita Ranch is still going through the approval process, but needs a general plan amendment since it exceeds the current general plan's parameters. The proposed residential development could also trigger a citywide vote if voters approve a citizens' initiative on non-conforming projects in November. In other action, the Santee City Council met in closed session but delayed voting on a proposal to sell a parcel long planned for a new library in the Trolley Square Center and allow Excel Acquisitions to build a hotel instead. The council delayed action on the long-promised library parcel until February 26th, not because of objections raised by residents, but because negotiations between the parties have not yet concluded.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news across our border region.
Over 15 million acres have burned in Australia's deadly wildfires, nearly 10 times the amount scorched here in California last year. Scientists at the University of Sydney have estimated that as many as a billion animals may have perished in Australia's devastating bushfires, putting some species at risk of extinction. The fires have killed tens of thousands of marsupials found nowhere else on Earth, including koalas and kangaroos, as well as birds such as glossy black cockatoos, reptiles, and amphibians. Researchers from the San Diego Zoo Global are in Australia working to rescue injured animals and relocate those in danger. The zoo and the San Diego Zoo Safari Park donated an amount equal to all paid admissions on Sunday, January 12th, to save wildlife in Australia. Now, donations are being accepted online to help the zoo's team rescue and care for wildlife such as koalas left stranded and endangered by the Australian fires. Donations will also help provide food and water, as well as assist with long-term repopulation. You too can donate to help the zoo's team help Australia's wildlife at endextinction.org/help. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
San Diego's most prominent civil rights leader, Dr. Carol Wayman, has passed away at age 94. As the executive director of San Diego's first human rights agency, the Citizens Interracial Committee, he was a tireless fighter for justice who broke down many barriers for people of color. Born May 15, 1925, Wayman was the grandson of a slave and the son of a Methodist minister. He was one of seven children, including his sister, the late jazz musician Nina Simone. While working on the Los Angeles Human Relations Agency back in 1964, at the height of the civil rights movement, Wayman came to San Diego at the request of our city council to help address racial issues here, and he never left. He soon founded the Citizens Interracial Committee dedicated to breaking down racial barriers. East County Magazine interviewed Wayman in January 2009 during a local viewing of the inauguration of Barack Obama, our nation's first African-American president. For Wayman, who once served as San Diego's delegate to the funeral of Martin Luther King, Jr., Obama's achievement was a major milestone. He recalled that when he first came to San Diego, quote, "Police beat up black kids and brown kids. There were restrictive housing covenants." Wayman championed efforts that integrated housing communities not only for African Americans, but others, including Jewish people in La Jolla who were facing discrimination as well. He led a series of historic City Hall meetings and grassroots forums around San Diego four decades ago, after race riots occurred across the nation. He also played a key role in a lawsuit that forced desegregation of San Diego City schools. The Citizens Interracial Committee was dissolved in 1969 after an incident in Mountain View Park that resulted in the death of a black youth, several injuries, and the arrest of 115 people. A report by the committee criticized police for sparking the confrontation into what it called a serious disaster. Soon after, the city launched an investigation of the committee that resulted in its termination. But in its few short years, the committee's accomplishments were vast, and Wayman continued his advocacy for civil rights throughout his lifetime. In a second interview with East County Magazine, later in 2009, Wayman recalled in his own words some of the accomplishments of which he was most proud, and here are some of his quotes. "We opened up all of the cities in the county so that all of us could live there without the KKK burning a cross onto our lawns. We nullified or removed the restrictive covenants. We wrote the first equal employment opportunity ordinances for the city and county and opened up many more opportunities for employment. We helped make it possible for blacks to be able to stay in the major hotels in the county. We made it possible for blacks to be able to try on clothes in and be hired by department stores. We enabled blacks to be able to eat in the major restaurants. We got the Union Tribune to start running stories about the black social set in 1966. Wayman also held a doctoral degree, worked as a teacher, and he authored 15 books. One of his best-known books, titled On Being Black in San Diego, Anytown, USA, was published in 1994. He amassed an impressive library chronicling San Diego's turbulent civil rights history, which was acquired by San Diego State University for future scholars in posterity. Wayman received many honors in his lifetime. He was named by KPBS as a local hero in 2013. He received the Jackie Robinson YMCA Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Human Dignity Award. He was also honored with the Somali Youth United Community Award. And Wayman was slated to be Grand Marshal in the 2020 Martin Luther King Jr. Day Parade in San Diego, but he died just days before that event. Clara Harris, the director of the Heartland Human Relations Agency in East County that Wayman helped establish, told the Union Tribune back in 2008, "Many young people have no appreciation of the struggle that Carol Wayman went through."
Wayman reflected in his interview with us in 2009 that San Diego is a different city today, citing changes in employment law as among his most lasting accomplishments, as well as housing. But despite progress made, he noted, there remains a long way to go. He voiced concerns over a shortage of people of color in the media, setbacks to desegregation in education, racial inequalities that still exist in law enforcement despite some improvements, and a prison system he called the New Plantation due to the high incarceration rate of blacks. Speaking long before the current administration of President Donald Trump and a resurgence in racial tensions nationwide, Wayman closed his 2009 interview by offering up his hope for the future to see San Diego, quote, create a mechanism for working toward greater harmony and openness in society. A memorial service for Dr. Wayman is scheduled for Friday, January 24th at 11 a.m. at Bethel Baptist Church in San Diego. An earlier viewing will be held January 23rd at 5 p.m. at Anderson Ragsdale Funeral Home in San Diego. The ACLU Foundation of San Diego and Imperial Counties posted a message online after learning of Wayman's death. The civil rights group praised his many successful achievements in the fight for equal rights and racial justice. The ACLU ended its post with this wish for Dr. Carol Wayman. Rest in power. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice. This is Miriam Raftery.
John David Bittner of Julian was known to many for the Hawkwatch programs he led for decades at the Wildlife Research Institute that he founded in Ramona and later at the Beegent Ranch. His educational programs also highlighted owls, falcons, and other birds of prey. He was considered a top local expert on eagles, studying the nesting ecology locally of golden eagles and bald eagles for the past 3 decades. Last week, Bittner died after falling 50 feet down a cliff in the Bandy Canyon area of San Pasqual Valley, where he was rappelling down the steep slope to replace batteries and memory cards in a camera near a golden eagle nest. He was 75 years old. The Wildlife Research Institute posted on its Facebook page, "We will miss him dearly and are so thankful for his work and dedication to saving wildlife and their special habitat." The organization held an impromptu memorial service Saturday during the Hawkwatch program at the Beegent Ranch, which it pledges to continue. Bittner's wildlife research included studies on eagle habitat commissioned by energy companies for major projects including Tule Wind in McCain Valley, Ocotillo Wind, and the Energia Sierra Juarez project in Mexico. His work on those projects drew controversy in 2013 when he pled guilty to failing to file data reports on some banded birds and to unlawful taking of one golden eagle without a permit. He was sentenced to probation and a fine. Bittner said that his permit was dormant for the years in question and that he objected to turning over the locations of eagles' nests to the government, fearing the public would learn the locations and encroach on threatened or endangered species. The active eagle nest that he was documenting when he died was among the first in his study of eagle nesting, according to the Wildlife Research Institute, and was recently threatened by potential trail development. The Wildlife Research Institute has vowed to continue the Hawkwatch programs that Bittner established to educate the public on the importance of raptors or birds of prey to, in their words, keep his legacy shining on without hesitation. The Hawkwatch program is available each Saturday in January and February at 10 a.m. You can find more information at wildlife-research.org.
SDG&E has begun construction to place power lines underground east of downtown Julian along a section of State Route 78 known as Banner Grade, as well as on Cape Horn Avenue. The project aims to reduce wildfire risk and allow key facilities to remain open during safety power shutoffs, according to a press release issued by SDG&E. The power utility says that, unlike overhead power lines, underground lines do not present a fire risk during high winds and elevated fire danger conditions. Julian's commercial downtown district is already served by underground power lines. As a result, SDG&E has been able to power Main Street businesses with a mobile generator during power shutoffs, but that hasn't helped nearby community facilities. Facilities that benefit from undergrounding work now being done include Julian's Post Office, High School, Elementary School, County Library, and the Cal Fire Station, as well as a County Public Works Maintenance Yard and a school bus yard. The Julian project will be completed in two phases over the next few months, though unforeseen weather conditions could affect the construction schedule. Motorists may experience traffic delays along Main Street, Banner Road, and Cape Horn Avenue during construction hours between 7 a.m. and 5:30 p.m. 7 days a week until completion. Traffic control will be in place to direct traffic in the area. Since the devastating 2007 firestorms, SDG&E has invested in undergrounding many lines as well as replacing many wood poles with fire-resistant steel poles. It has also built a sophisticated weather monitoring network and forged partnerships to enhance wildfire prevention and responses. Reporting for Eaves County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Paul Cruz.
This is Jonathan Goetz with a sports report. Rocky Long, the all-time winningest coach in the Mountain West and second winningest coach in San Diego State history, has announced that he is retiring as the head football coach at SDSU. Long guided the Aztecs to an 81-38 record in 9 seasons and led San Diego State to 3 Mountain West titles as well as a bowl appearance. He previously coached at UCLA, Oregon State, New Mexico, and other schools before joining the Aztecs in 2009 as defense coordinator and later named head coach. Over his career, he won 143 victories in the Mountain West and was named Mountain West's Coach of the Year 3 times. Long will be replaced as head coach by Brady Hoke. He has twice been chosen as National Coach of the Year. Hoke brings 35 years of coaching experience at the collegiate level, including 12 seasons as football head coach at Michigan, San Diego State, and Ball State University. He has received Conference Coach of the Year accolades in 3 different leagues. In his first stint as head coach of the Aztecs, Hoke took over a program that had lost 2/3 of the games in its prior season. That year, 2010, the Aztecs finished with a 9-4 record, defeating the Navy team in the Poinsettia Bowl, and Hoke was named Mountain West Coach of the Year. The Aztecs have since gone to compete in 10 straight bowl games. After successful stints coaching at other schools, Hoke rejoined the Aztecs last year and looks forward to continuing the team's winning streak.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. And today, my very special guest is Nancy Cassidy. Nancy is a Democrat challenging incumbent Congressman Scott Peters, also a Democrat, in the March primary. Nancy, welcome to the show.
Very glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, this is the 52nd district. Not to be confused, listeners, we know Duncan Hunter's district used to be the 52nd. Now it's the 50th. And the 52nd is now represented by Congressman Peters. Nancy, can you tell us what areas the 52nd district includes now?
Well, the 52nd district runs along the coast, takes in Coronado, Ocean Beach, Pacific Beach, some of most of La Jolla, and stops at the university campus and makes a hard east turn over to Poway, Mira Mesa, and Rancho Bernardo.
So it does include some of our inland areas east of I-15 out here as well. The district is fairly evenly split. I understand there's about 136,000 Democrats, 130,000 declined to state voters, and then 128,000 Republicans in that district. Which way do those declined to state voters tend to sway, Nancy?
They tend to be more liberal. I think people that live along the coast certainly have more interest in the natural world than some other areas, and so they tend to be more environmentally conscious and a little more progressive.
Right. And there's a total of four candidates in the race, we should add. There is a Republican, Jim DeBello, and then a no-party preference candidate named Ryan Cunningham. That's kind of an ironic name in a district that used to be represented by Congressman Duke Cunningham, who, of course, wound up with about 7 years in the slammer for, right. for corruption. So good likelihood you could wind up seeing even two Democrats make it into a runoff in this race.
It's possible. There is a probability that the Republican candidate is going to be well-financed, as is the incumbent.
Okay. So, Nancy, you're running as the Green New Deal candidate, taking on the incumbent Democrat. Listeners, a little bit of background on Nancy Cassidy. She is a California native. For 20 years, she's been the general manager of the Ocean Beach People's Food Cooperative, an organic store. She has spent 7 years as the governor's appointee to the Food and Agriculture Board in Sacramento. She's a lifelong Democrat. She spent 8 years as a pro-choice professional lobbyist in Sacramento. On the environmental field, she's been an activist opposing the San Onofre nuclear plant. And, perhaps most importantly for this race, she was a co-founder of the San Diego Climate Mobilization Coalition. She did run before in 1996 for Congress and took over a third of the vote in a three-way Democratic primary. That race was ultimately won by Republican Brian Bilbray. So, Nancy, tell us what compelled you to jump in and challenge an incumbent Democratic congressman based on the Green New Deal?
Well, Marian, I believe that we are in a climate emergency and we need to act like it. I believe that our elected representatives have a duty to warn when we are in danger. And this is not happening in the 52nd District. I've spent personal time and group time trying to get the present incumbent to realize we need to act boldly and decisively to handle this ever-worsening crisis with our climate.
Can you give us some actual facts about this? You mentioned a duty to warn. What would you like our listeners today to know about the climate crisis?
Well, first of all, we have scientific solutions that should be in place to mitigate the worst impacts. We are currently, as a global nation, putting up 110 million tons of carbon dioxide pollution every single day. At this rate, we have less than 8 years before that amount of pollution heats the planet beyond the 1.5 degree Celsius rise that science tells us is required if we are going to continue to have a predictable food supply.
So if there's no more food supply, basically we're talking about the potential extinction of humanity based on these latest dire predictions.
That is correct.
It doesn't get any scarier than that. So tell us what the Green New Deal includes. I'm sure some people out there have heard it, may not understand exactly what that means.
There are actually two parts of the Green New Deal. There's the green part, and then there's the New Deal part. So the green part calls for a national mobilization of the country, an industrial mobilization that would build out the wind, water, and solar energy system and provide the country with a new grid, a smart grid to transfer that energy around the country on a scale as if we were in a war. In addition, it calls for the conversion of 250 million trucks and cars, light trucks and cars, to electric motors. It also calls for climate-smart agriculture, which is our best defense for sequestering carbon.
Very good. And I believe there's also things in there like replanting our forests and composting, and as you've mentioned, the conversion to vehicles that run on alternate fuels or are powered by electricity, which would all help reduce the amount of energy that we use, as well as converting that energy that we do have to have to make sure that it's all coming from sustainable and renewable resources, correct?
Correct. So that's the green side of the Green New Deal. The New Deal side says, in addition to these initiatives, we need to be providing medical care, Medicare for All, a single-payer universal coverage system for all of our citizens.
Super. And we'll get to all of the other aspects in a minute, but I had a couple of other questions on the environmental part of it. I understand that this would also help provide a lot of economic revitalization and jobs. How many jobs do you estimate would be created if the Green New Deal were rolled out?
Conservatively, it looks like about 6 million, and that compensates for the approximately 4 million members of the workforce in the fossil fuel industry that'll have to be retrained into the new energy system.
And these are not, you know, low-wage, dead-end jobs, right?
Not at all. These are technical jobs, human resources jobs. This is a massive retooling of the economy with the base of sustainable energy.
Correct. Now, as with all new technologies, there, you know, occasionally are some downsides. In East County, we've seen some projects, particularly some of the big wind projects, that were not entirely benign. There have been some issues, things like brush fires and blades being thrown off and lights flashing in people's windows and some of these things. Do you support recognizing that while we have to have a massive rollout, you know, to convert our energy away from the fossil fuels, do you believe that we need to have some smart reforms also in terms of where these things can and should be located to make sure that we're not substituting one set of problems for another set for the people that live there?
That's an excellent way of putting it. We definitely need to have oversight. We need to have regulation. And luckily, we have a blueprint that's been provided by the think tank at Stanford, headed by Dr. Mark Jacobson, where they have done, with much support from the feds, not from the Department of Energy, but actually from the Department of Defense, to computer model the new energy locations for the entire United States. This has taken about 9 years. The last 2 years, Dr. Jacobson and his team have been converting 139 countries because this is a global climate effort.
Yeah, that's so important. And it even includes things like wave and tide machines. There's a lot of really cutting edge, innovative stuff we may not have even seen in the beginning of everything yet to come. But we have to make it through those 8 years somehow. I think that it's important to note that in addition to contrasting yourself against Scott Peters, who hasn't gone far enough, in your opinion, in fully supporting a Green New Deal, but also to educate listeners a little bit about the Republican Party stance on the whole climate change issue, or at least the Republicans that are currently, you know, in control of the Senate and the White House. Can you address that?
Well, we believe that with a president who calls climate change a hoax, who has been rolling back the safeguards, and who is encouraging, if we can believe this, more coal production, the Republican Party of old seems to have been subsumed by this slavish devotion to a person who obviously does not know what he's talking about.
And President Trump, we should note, has also called for opening up the coastline right here off of California to offshore drilling, as well as fracking in other parts of California and many other parts of the United States as well, while not supporting conversion to cleaner, greener fuels.
I think it is not overstating to say this is actually a crime against humanity. The current fossil fuel industry is causing over 200,000 premature deaths a year in the United States due to pollution from these fossil fuels. So when you know those facts and you continue to not only encourage the activity, I think that people need to be aware that this is beyond just an incidental misunderstanding of the situation.
Now, we're going to be talking in a minute about some of the other initiatives that you support, some of which listeners may be asking, well, how would you pay for all of this? And I know when we were talking before we went on the air, you told me that part of the Green New Deal vision that you have would be for the United States to be able to actually sell energy off of all these new wind, solar, geothermal, everything else they come up with, energy, as part of what would be basically kind of like a national community choice energy program. In other words, instead of people writing their check every month to SDG&E or PG&E or whoever it might be, there would be an alternative for the United States government to be selling the power, hopefully cheaper than what people are paying for it now, but using the profit to put into other programs. Let's talk about some of the other programs. Go ahead and tell me about your health care plan.
Well, before we leave this subject, just remember that when you increase the workforce with good paying jobs, those people pay taxes into our system. So that's another source of revenue when True. We are being able to have good paying jobs in the new industry. The other part of the Green New Deal, which is the New Deal part that I think is as important, would provide medical coverage for all. It would also provide for public college to be tuition free, and it would provide for a number of new technologies that would be innovated as we look at new possibilities.
Yeah, all very exciting. I know we were chatting off air and the healthcare costs are just spiraling out of control. A lot of folks I know that are in that 55 to 65 age bracket, especially who aren't old enough for Medicare yet, are getting bills of, you know, like $1,000 a month for right. basically crummy healthcare plans, not very good healthcare plans, and still have high deductibles. And of course, if you're very poor, I guess there are subsidies, but for a lot of people who are middle class, they just can't even afford healthcare anymore.
Well, that is a big concern, especially for young families. So this idea that somehow Medicare for All is going to cost us more, we actually need to look at what we're paying now. Something as simple as your homeowner's insurance carries costs for medical care if someone is injured on your property.
Right.
Your car insurance has that same kind of rider. Mm-hmm. So there are these hidden, you might say, costs that we are already paying the people that accessed our emergency rooms because that's their only alternative. It's been studied and restudied in other industrialized countries. We know that their results are better and their costs are lower and everyone is covered as a right. And I think that for the United States to have anything less than that is unacceptable.
Very good. Thank you for sharing that. On the free college tuition to all public colleges, so that would mean things in California, such as the University of California, the Cal State system, and some community colleges. You've mentioned that you also support student loan forgiveness.
Correct. I think college debt forgiveness makes good economic sense because it allows the young people who are coming out of college to be able to get into the workforce and then do those things that we all want to do, have families, buy homes, get ourselves situated financially so that we can actually look forward to a workforce that's productive and competitive with the rest of the world. Free college tuition and forgiveness of college debt is a actual economic driver rather than something that we need to look at as expensive for the country.
Yeah, there you go. It's basically an investment in the future of our children and the future of our country. Nancy, you have been a longtime champion of women's rights. And right now we're at a time when hard-fought freedoms for women are under assault. There's really no other word for it. In Washington, in many states across the country, where we're seeing very extreme laws being passed, challenges being brought forward with the Supreme Court, probably one vote away from overturning Roe versus Wade, the historic abortion rights case. And of course, it's not just abortion. We're seeing birth control attack, basic pay equality for women. We still don't have an Equal Rights Amendment, and that's about to be fought out again because now the Virginia legislature has flipped and they're pass it, and they would be the last state needed to approve it. I guess it'll be a court battle whether that gets to count after so many years or not. But can you comment on the importance of women's issues and why, in your opinion, that's something that we shouldn't just forget about amid all the other issues out there?
Well, let me just say my position about reproductive choice. If we allow the government to make that decision, current opinion says no abortions. But the same principle of allowing the government to decide this decision would in other times perhaps mandate mandatory abortions. So we have to look at this as a two-sided argument. It's just because things are running one way now. If the government is the decider, it opens the door to a very, very dire future.
Interesting point. We've certainly seen that in China, where they had the one-child policy for a long time, and women were forced to get abortions there.
But I also believe the attack on women is like the attack on Mother Earth. If we respected women, if we saw our role in society as the life givers, we would be able also to have the consciousness that our planet is life-giving, and furthermore, that we are all connected in this web of life. So I see them as coming out of the same kind of mentality of dominance, of disrespect.
In other words, it's about control, really, more than concern for the life of, you know, every fertilized egg. And I don't want to diminish that, but when we hear the term pro-life, so often they're only talking about the life of the fetus or the baby or whatever term you want to use, but we forget that there's a woman's life at stake, too. In some cases, her life may actually be in danger carrying a baby to term, or her health may be in danger, or you may have a not really viable fetus that I had a friend where they found out in the seventh month that every organ was growing on the outside of the body. I mean, there's no way that that can be a viable child if it's born.
Right, correct. But more importantly, this is a private decision. It needs to be a personal decision. And the history of this subject has taken many twists and turns over the years. So we have had a moving line. It's not ever going to be decided on a faith alone. And that is why I think it needs to reside with the person that is the affected person, and that is the bearer of life.
We've been talking about domestic issues so far, but of course, foreign policy is much in the news right now. As we're recording this, it's right after we saw President Trump order the killing, some call it the assassination, of an Iranian General Soleimani, and that resulted in Iran retaliating by bombing U.S. military bases over there. And coming out of that, we then saw Iran accidentally, they say, shoot down a Ukrainian airliner because they thought maybe the U.S. was firing back at them. So a lot of consequences to that action. I would like to ask you, Nancy, if you could comment, please, on the current U.S. policy in Iraq and Iran, and whether you agree or disagree with the direction that things are going in and what you might do differently if you had a vote in Congress.
Well, let me say, first of all, that I don't think this is the first assassination that the United States has ever carried out. Secondly, we must confront a new reality. As a universe of people, of humans on the planet, we are facing an existential threat in our lifetime. And these excursions into foreign policy decisions that result in chaos and upset and distraction and, let me say, death to primarily non-combatant women and children, history shows, they have to stop. This is not the way forward for life on planet Earth. So, like we tell our kids, the first thing we must do is recognize we are no longer going to be solving our problems by force. We must sit down, we must talk, we must mediate, arbitrate, communicate in order to solve problems that are human-made and human-solved.
And it should be noted, too, that all of those destructive things that happen in war, the explosions, the bombs, all of that contributes to the massive releases of the CO2 and all the things that are contributing to climate change as well.
And let's talk about the cost. We've just passed a bill, that a budget that allows a $1.4 trillion upgrade of the United States nuclear arsenal, which we know we will never be able to use. Can you imagine if we were using that kind of money on the border as we face our crisis with immigration? This is where we should be directing our resources.
Yeah, and the national debt is going way up currently, so that's another problem.
That's another problem.
Listeners, if you just tuned in, we are speaking with Nancy Cassidy. She is a Democratic candidate running on a Green New Deal platform. She is challenging Democrat Scott Peters in the 52nd Congressional District. Nancy, where can people get more information about you and your candidacy?
Well, we're on all kinds of social media platforms, but the easiest thing is to go to the web Cassidy for Congress, and we spell our name C-A-S-A-D-Y, and we're easy to find.
So CassidyForCongress.com. I am going to let you have the last word today, Nancy. Is there anything else you would like our listeners to know that we haven't already talked about here, or any elaboration on anything that we did bring up?
Well, I want to say that every day we wait to address this climate crisis increases our vulnerability and decreases our chances for survival. This is no longer what is possible. We must confront what is necessary for us to survive, and we must let young people know that they are not in this fight alone, and that's why I'm running in the 52nd District.
Very good. Yeah, I think if we look around the world and just look at the headlines in the last month, the massive worst ever wildfires in Australia, the worst ever wildfires burning the Amazon, the worst ever fires that we had in the last year right here in California, the melting of the polar caps in Greenland, and of course, 97% of the world's climate scientists warning us for some years now that climate change is real, that it isn't cyclical, and that man is the major contributor to the problem. So it's important, I think, for us to help get that word out, to talk to candidates that are concerned about what's happening in the effort to protect our world and all of the people on it. So, Nancy, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to join us today on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The San Diego Blood Bank has put out an urgent plea for both type O positive and O negative blood donors due to a shortage. David Wellis, the CEO of the blood bank, says, coming out of the holiday season, we typically see a decrease in donations of all types due to schools being out of session for the holidays and seasonal illnesses like the flu. But he adds the need for type O blood has hit a critically low level, and we need the community to help us keep a safe supply for local hospital patients. Type O positive, the most common blood type, is often needed for hospital patients. Type O negative, the universal donor blood type, can be given to any patient and is often used in emergency rooms when there is no time to test a patient's blood type. To be eligible to give blood, donors must be at least 17 years old, weigh at least 114 pounds, and be in generally good health. All eligible donors with type O positive or negative blood are encouraged to donate immediately to help save lives. The San Diego Blood Bank has a half dozen donor centers throughout San Diego County plus 10 blood mobiles, making it convenient to donate. Here in East County, the Blood Bank is located at 776 Arnell Avenue in El Cajon. You can get a full list of locations and make an appointment to give blood at sandiegobloodbank.org or by calling 1-800-4-MY-SDBB, as in San Diego Blood Bank. Walk-ins are also welcome. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.